All right. This is the part two, second section in our series about artificial intelligence and halakha. So let's just recap where we are now. Last time we talked about the principles of artificial intelligence. We broke it down just for useful purposes into three tkufot of artificial intelligence based on when machines beat humans at video games. The first we talked about was when Deep Blue defeated Gary Kasparov in chess. And the way that it did that was because it knew all of the games that had been playing in chess. And so it was able to predict what the best move was based on previous moves in previous games of chess. And it was actually, it was always being updated by its programmers with old games of chess and with new games of chess as they came out. And that's how it beat Kasparov, basically, by knowing what had been done in the past and what the best move would be in the future. The next iteration, I guess you would say, was Watson. I forget the year, 2000, you wrote it down, I think 2004, when Watson beat Ken Jennings and other Jeopardy champions. And the way that he did it, because this is different than chess, this is winning in a trivia game where you have to understand, you have to in some way teach the computer to understand a question so that it can know what the answer should be, or vice versa, understand an answer so it knows what the question should be, in Jeopardy's case. And there, the computer used natural language processing, which is to say it parsed based on the word usage in the answers, and a vast database of information, and was able to somehow build up a probability chart of whether or not it had the right answers. And as we pointed out, when it got it right faster than anybody else. And when it got it wrong extremely humorously. Like, the answers made no sense because it doesn't really know anything. It just knows how to pretend like it knows something. But in that way, it had better algorithms for understanding what the answer should be based on its database than any human being. And then the final leap, which is the leap that we're currently in, is there are various terms for it, machine learning, deep learning, reinforcement learning, where the computer teaches itself. You provide a goal to the computer, and the computer basically plays the game against itself, learning what the rules are, what the best strategies are, and based on that, it becomes the best player that it could possibly be. And this really hit its apex, one of its apexes, I guess, when it actually defeated the reigning champion computer in the old way of playing chess. In other words, the machine learning computer beat the classic, huge database, previous knowledge computer. And so that was kind of one of the signs that that machine learning and deep learning is the best way. And in a way, machine learning and deep learning mimics, only on a grander scale, the way that the human mind works and the way that we understand things and the way that we go about performing in the world. And that's what we talked about. And then we turned towards we said we were going to turn towards several issues. And we focused for now on the theoretical idea of a psak machine. Okay? And we talked about the idea of a psak machine. The idea of saying, okay, here's my shayla. I want to enter it into a computer, and the computer will spit back to me what the psak should be. Obviously, it's not going to be an easy one. I'm not going to ask it, should I give tzedakah today? That's going to be silly. But some kind of complex question, the nature of which you might ask of Rabbi Yosef or of Moshe Feinstein or of Asher Weiss or of Schechter, that kind of complicated question that you would need a competent posek, someone who, has a tremendous amount of knowledge at his fingertips and should also have the knowledge of how to use that knowledge, of how to use that database of knowledge and come up with a psak. Do we think that it's possible that one day a computer should perform that function? That's what we started to talk about.
Like they have Google rabbis, then you Google the rabbi and you can ask him any question you want. It's the same thing.
Well, it's a little bit different than that, because there you're still asking a rabbi. Here, you're not even asking a rabbi. There's no human intervention at all. You have an AI that's going to spit back an answer to you and say, this is what the psak should be. So do we think that that's a good idea? Do we think it's possible?
On what basis will the computer know the answer?
It knows everything. It knows all the tshuvas. Yeah, it knows shas and poskim backwards and forwards, and it has some kind of We could go about it a bunch of different ways. We could teach the computer how to do it, you know, manually. We could input algorithms like they did for Deep Blue and like they did for Jeopardy and Watson. And we should say, you know, we could say this halachic value overrides that halachic value, something along those lines. Or we could just let the computer do it himself.
Are there sort of meta principles, you know, when you...
For sure.
So you could program that in.
You could program that in, or you could have him read all the tshuvas ever written, and then he could figure out what the principles are. Because he could. Right? That's what the computer does. Based on its information. So those are both options. Is either one of those a good option? And how would we go about deciding? Right, so that's where one of the first point we made was Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, where he talks about how the human nature is a large factor in the process of coming up with psak, and for a few different reasons. One was that it's kind of leaning on those meta halachic principles. The idea that, for example, in cases of aguna, you know, if you just read the black letter halacha, if you just looked in Shulchan Aruch and saw and read and, you know, talked about a specific case, you might come to the conclusion that we should be stringent. And Rav Lichtenstein pointed out that many poskim said, okay, but when it comes to aguna, or when it comes to, for example, mamzer, or any case like that, where you need an extra dose of compassion, so you might lean towards being lenient. And he argues, he's not talking about computers at the time, although he uses that metaphor, says only a human would do that. Only a human would be lenient in that way. And we pointed out that that's not necessarily true. And with the computers that we're talking about, it could learn to be compassionate, in theory. That could happen. So that was one point that he made. Another point that he made, if you remember, was that another factor that enters into the equation for a posek is also his previous lifetime experience. In other words, the things that have happened to him. What? Yeah, the post experience himself. In other words, yes, you can talk about how to treat the person on the other end of the tshuva. But what about the person writing the tshuva? We find when you look at the literature, we find that very, very often the personality and the previous history of the posek enters into his psak. We saw the best example of that, I think, was the Masat Binyamin, who writes about his experience of trying to come up with a proper conclusion to the following question. Can a blind person receive an aliyah?
Yeah.
Can he receive an aliyah at the Torah? And why was this so burning for him? Because he had become blind. He was a major posek, and he had become blind, and he knew that the Shulchan Aruch states as a matter of, you know, strict halacha, that a blind person cannot receive an aliyah. And he struggles with it. And you can feel at the outset that he's going to try to come to the conclusion that his case is different. And he writes, because I feel a burning need to. And he's being transparent, and we view that as valid, that he has the right to put his personal experiences into his psak, and that's perfectly normal. Now, presumably a computer, I don't dare I say, would never be able to do that, because he won't have personal experiences. It would seem.
What would you say is the most important determinant in reaching an accurate psak halacha? Is it the...
What would who say? Rav Lichtenstein. What would I say?
Is it the knowledge of precedent? Or is it the, you know, the more intangible...
It would have to be that knowledge married with the human spirit. You know?
Is it related to compassion in some ways? In knowledge, you're giving a psak on the person. The amount of community, you know the person. So he might say to one, I know of a case where they were talking about giving two people being asked if they can use a dishwasher on Shabbat.
Right.
For one, the Rav said no, one the Rav said yes.
Yeah.
He knew the difference of the levels of the family.
That's actually a very interesting point that I want to return to in a few minutes.
There is a rabbi in Ronana.
But I think it's going to come from the opposite direction of where you're expecting.
There is a rabbi in Ronana that does daf yomi, and he sits with someone. Yaakov Shav goes to him, he's blind, and the other one reads to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have Rav Yefit.
Sure, sure. You have people like that.
I was going to say there's another example. There is a case where we consider hesed mamanot, right? We consider loss of money.
Right.
So, if, for example, if there's a case that involves loss of 1,000 shkalim,
right.
For some people, a loss of 1,000 shkalim
right.
is a pittance.
Right.
Well, for other people, the loss of 1,000 shekalim is a major factor in their lifestyle.
Right. So this is actually something very, very interesting. And I'll give you another example. You know what? I'll make your point even stronger. This I just found on a website. It was just a random person. I don't know the name of the person. He said, we are easily decades, if not more, away from artificial intelligence vis-a-vis a lot of the skills that are needed for a good psak. For instance, a young rabbi was training with Moshe Feinstein. He saw two instances where a woman brought this. What?
Do we have this?
It should be in there, yeah. Yeah, it's in italics. He saw two instances where a woman brought the same type of questionably kosher chicken to Rabbi Feinstein, who prohibited the first and permitted the second. Rav Moshe explained that the first woman struck him as someone who wouldn't be stressed by throwing out one chicken, so he had to do so. But he could tell that the second woman desperately needed that chicken. Exactly your case. And the claim over here being made is that a computer would not be able to make those kinds of fine human distinctions to notice that this person needs the money and this person does not, and therefore this person can throw out the chicken, this person, he can be lenient for that. Why are you squinting?
Are we saying that rabbis are right in the way that they're applying the halakha? Because maybe we shouldn't be applying it differently for those two instances. Maybe that's the wrong principle. Justice should not be perverted by the, if you're wealthy or poor, and neither should halakha. Maybe when we have a psak, it should be, that's the way it is.
Well, you're assuming that there's only one standard for everybody, right?
Well, I'm questioning, but we know there isn't. Whether or not, is it better to have this wayfaring rabbinic oversight that says, oh, for you it's like this, but for you it's like this, assuming to have all the knowledge, and you probably don't. You have maybe some knowledge, probably just a sliver, which is...
What knowledge? My knowledge of people?
The knowledge of people,
okay,
and compassion, your perception of compassion.
So interesting. So again, I would disagree with you, but maybe you'll be surprised where I'm going to go with this. I was thinking a lot about this week, and I actually think that in this one area, this guy is so off, and Uri, you're so off, that it's the exact opposite of what you would expect. And I submit to you what we saw in this last year with Cambridge Analytica. You know Cambridge. You guys know what Cambridge Analytica is, right? That's the company that was using Facebook to, this is their claim, to basically sway the election for Trump and many other elections, by the way, throughout the world, by basically using Facebook data to target certain voters that they felt were on the fence and to send them news stories, or fake news stories in some cases, that made the case. Now, what's the big deal about Cambridge Analytica? The big deal is that they were actually able to identify which people they could sway based on what they had posted on Facebook, based on their purchase history, all this kinds of information that exists in the cloud that we don't know. Right, but it's not just, general profile. Profiles of specific individuals, which means that it is very simple, almost laughably simple, for companies in the world to know more about you than anybody else does. Because we tell computers about ourselves all the time when we use the computer. Our computers know us better than our spouses do. They know us better than our siblings do, than our parents do, and possibly even better than we ourselves do. There's that story. Do you guys know the Target story? This is the best example of this ever. Target in around the year beginning of the 2000s. You know the story? Around the years of the beginning of the 2000s, a girl came in to Target and made some purchases. Target is a major store in America.
Major chain
of stores in America.
At the end of
your purchase, when you finish a purchase, they give you a printout of coupons of things that, maybe you're interested in these things the next time you come to the store. Now, behind the curtain, Target was tracking your purchase history, and it wasn't giving you coupons. It was giving you coupons for things that they thought you might be interested in because of your purchase history.
Yeah, but all shops do that these days.
These days, yeah. At the time, that was revolutionary. They had people that were writing algorithms for this. It was very exciting. It was new at the time, 2000. 16-year-old girl comes into the store. She makes her purchases, and then she gets the printout of coupons, and on there is diapers, formula, all kinds of things for babies. And she brings it home. Her father sees it. He's furious. Why are you offering these things to my daughter? Like, he goes back to the store. He's yelling at the manager. The manager knows anything about this. Judy, what is this? A couple of days later, he comes back. apologizes. I had a long talk with my daughter. And it turns out that she's pregnant. She didn't even know. She didn't even know. After she took a pregnancy test, she didn't know. Why, how did they figure out? Because she was buying ice cream, and she was buying pickles, and she was buying all the things that stereotypically a pregnant woman buys when she's pregnant, and she hadn't, she herself didn't even know that she was pregnant. Okay? So that's where we were 20 years ago. So where are we now? What am I getting at? What I'm getting at is, not only could the computer come up with the kinds of conclusions that Rav Moshe Feinstein comes up in this story, but he could probably do it even, the computer could do it even better.
Maybe faster.
Faster and better. The computer, Rav Moshe only knows about this woman who comes in front of him because, you know, he happens to, he looks at her appearance, he happens to know her maybe, maybe he knows her, he doesn't know everybody, he doesn't know everything about everybody. But the computer, you imagine, imagine you put in a psak, you put in a question to the computer, and the computer, instead of just spitting back whatever the Shulchan Aruch says, goes through everything, and then doesn't stop there, it goes through everything about you. Everything you're looking at, everything you've bought, everything, whatever, what school you send your kids to, what shul you go to, what languages you speak, what job you work at.
Assuming you put all that information online.
But we all do.
Oh, it's all there. It's all there.
And in the future, it definitely will be. Imagine the kind of depth that it would have, so to speak, if it knew how to use that information properly, to give you the ultimate tailored psak. That would be, you know, the counter example to the counter claim.
That's a full assessment, as opposed to just a happenstance meeting with the rabbi who's how are they feeling, how are you feeling? Do they know? Did you explain yourself? Did they hear? Were they distracted? That's a very partial view.
You're right, but we're human, so that's what, you know, he does his best. He does his best.
I'm saying that the computer,
yeah, the computer could theoretically do it better. Could theoretically do better.
But your question still stands. Why should there be a difference in psak between an individual? That's the question you
asked,
right?
It's another one, yeah.
But it's incorrect, because there are different standards. There is no doubt that there should be a different answer depending on a person's background status. I think Jake was more worried about how did Rav Moshe really know that this woman needed that psak and that woman needed that psak. The fact that there will be different psak for different people, but depending on circumstances, that's a basic fundamental principle in halacha. It's not surprising, it shouldn't be. I actually put on the sources a couple of instances of this in pop culture, right? You've seen the movie Minority Report?
No.
People? Minority Report was a movie with Tom Cruise where basically they told the they had these people, in this case it was actually these people, I don't think it was computers, that could tell the future about what you were going to do. And based on that, they would prosecute you for crimes that you were going to do instead of crimes that you actually did. So imagine a computer that had that kind of information and could predict the future. I mean, it's making assumptions about the way that the world works. It's making assumptions that you can predict the future based on the past, which I give some other instance of this from comic books, also Sherlock Holmes. A lot of the Sherlock Holmes stories about this, about deductions, about predicting what people will do in the future based on what they did in the past. And I also put in one of my favorite stories that I've ever read. It's called I Sing the Body Electric. It's a short story by Ray Bradbury. And I'll just give you the back end of the story. You don't have to read much of it. But the back end of the story is that there's this family that has a tragedy. The mother dies. And so the father somehow gets a hold of this flyer that there's this company that makes life-size marionettes, puppets. And then you can get it to, you know, service your family. Because he needs somebody to work around the house. So he thought it was going to be like a maid. And this company is very mysterious. It's very it's very whimsical. And it sends them this robot grandmother. She's a grandmother. And it basically wins them over by just being so lifelike and so wise and so charming. And they're like blown away by how charming this grandmother is. And one of the daughters like hates it because it feels like it's replacing her mother. And also she's upset with her mother for dying. And there's a conversation. There's actually, I want to get to a few conversations from the story because it's just a beautiful story. At some point, the father starts talking to the grandmother. I'll read to you a little bit. It says, the father says, but all this talk of love and attention and stuff, good God, woman, you're not even in there. like talking to the robot, there's nothing in there. He gestured to her head, her face, her eyes, the hidden sensory cells behind the eyes, the miniaturized storage vaults and minimal keys. By the way, this story was probably written 50, 60 years ago. You're not in there. The grandmother waited. She said, no, but you are. You and Thomas and Timothy and Agatha, those are the children. Everything you ever say, everything you ever do, I'll keep, put away, treasure. I shall be all the things a family forgets it is, but senses, half remembers. Better than the old family albums you used to leaf through, saying, here's the winter and here's the spring. I will recall what you forget. And although the debate may run another 100,000 years, what is love? Perhaps we may find that love is the ability of someone to give us back to us. Maybe love is someone seeing and remembering, handing us back to ourselves just a trifle better than we had dared to hope or dream. I am family memory, and one day perhaps racial memory too, but in the round and at your call. I do not know myself. I can neither touch nor taste nor feel on any level. Yet I exist, and my existence means the heightening of your chance to touch and taste and feel. Isn't love in there somewhere in such an exchange? She goes on and she says, basically, her power is that she can give equal attention to everybody in the family. She can understand everybody. She doesn't get tired. She doesn't get angry. She doesn't lose patience. That's the power of a computer. And there's something to that in terms of, in some way, there is an advantage there. Now, we did mention last time, though, that there is also a concept that a posek has some amount of siyata dishmaya, has divine intervention. That when a posek gives a psak, because he's a human being, because he has worked hard in Torah and mitzvot, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives him some help. And this is something that Rabban writes about very heavily. And you'll find, I think this is probably the majority view, although I won't say that it is the unanimous view. You can find it in Gemara's as well.
A little bit self-serving.
I mean, I don't know whether the Ramban applied it to himself. He was definitely talking about the Sanhedrin when he said it. Self-serving. The Torah says, "Lo tosrim kol asher yigidu l'chayim yinusma." That's what Hashem says. Don't sway from what they say to the right or to the left.
Poskim have siyata
deshmaya,
but nevertheless, there are
poskim
who disagree.
And there are poskim
and
who are wrong.
And they each have siyata deshmaya.
And there are poskim who are wrong. Okay. And this is what we pointed out last time. The Ramban has a big problem because we have an entire korban dedicated to when the Sanhedrin is wrong. As Par Ha'alam Davar that they bring when they are wrong about something. So how could they be wrong? So that's a powerful question. The Ramban would probably have to say something along the lines that they made a mistake in the process. If you make a mistake in the process, then you're going to come to a faulty conclusion or something was wrong with them. Sometimes the Ramban even says that when they're wrong, they're right. I'll give an example from this past week's parasha. There's a rule. This is one of these collector's items, Rambans. You need to know this. There's a rule. James, you're going to love this. There's a rule that with Edim Zomimim. So Edim Zomimim is witnesses that they claim that Reuven killed Shimon. Right? Two witnesses come forward. They say Reuven killed Shimon. Then two other witnesses, and he killed Shimon in London. And we were there in London and we saw. Two other witnesses come and say, we don't know whether Reuven killed Shimon, but what we can tell you is that these two Edim were in Prague on that day. So they couldn't have been in London. We don't know anything about Reuven and Shimon. Now, even if two witnesses later come by and say, actually, Reuven really did kill Shimon in London, it doesn't matter. Those two first witnesses are called Edim Zomimin, and they are executed because they tried to get Reuven killed. Now here's the thing. The rule is that if Reuven... Actually, you know what? We don't even need to talk about the other rules. The Ramban says, but I don't understand, what happens... we do need to talk about the rules. I'm sorry. What happens if the Edim Zomimin testify? Right? And then Reuven is killed, and only a day later the second set of Edim come by and say... Oh, no, they were in Prague. In other words, we found out too late. Reuven's already been killed. Now what happens? What do we do to the Edim Zomimin? Now, surely, all of you will say, Kol Shekein, they should get killed, right? They successfully killed Reuven. So, obviously, they should be killed. This was a subject of, this is one of the major disputes between the Prushim and the Tzedukim. The Tzedukim agreed with all of you. I'm putting it into your mouth. And the Perushim, that's us, by the way, disagree, and they say, based on the Psukim, it's only Kasher Zamam, velo Kasher Asa. Kasher Zamam means what they planned, and not what they actually did. In other words, seemingly perversely, it's not perverse because that's not the halacha, but seemingly perversely, if they fail, they're killed, but if they succeed, they are not. Now the Gemara hangs this on the diyuk in the pasuk that it says kasher zamam velo kasher asa, and you can find all kinds of philosophical explanations for it. The Ramban's explanation is as follows: he says the fact that Reuven was killed means
he deserved
to be killed, and so ultimately the Edom Zomamin didn't do anything to Reuven that he didn't deserve. This is mind blowing Ramban, right? Says there was a mistake that was done, but ultimately it was just. He must have deserved to die for some other reason, and therefore we're not going to kill the Edom Zomamin because it can't be that the Shoftim made a mistake on this level. This is a very surprising Ramban. I don't know whether people disagree with it or not, because I really haven't researched anybody responding to it. But it's an instance where the Ramban actually even says when they're right, when they're wrong, they're right. It's an extreme example of when they're wrong, they're right. Right? Now, based on that, I would assume that we would probably conclude that a computer can't have siyata dishmaya. I could be wrong. And in fact, you know, it's very, I can imagine that we might be wrong. You know, if the siyata dishmaya just is for the sake of the psak and not based on the merit of the rabbi, so then maybe even a computer. But I'm skeptical of that. I would prefer to say, no, that it's the rabbi, the person who is, you know, steeped in Torah and steeped in trying to find out where Ton Hashem is, that gives him some mode of divine knowledge that a computer can never achieve. So that would be an argument against the psak machine. Well, I think the second point that I made was you know, connected to the neshama. In other words, the idea that there is some kind of interplay between God and man during the process of learning Torah and teaching Torah and coming up with psak, that it's somehow guided. You know, I'm not a shul rabbi, but a shul rabbi would like to believe that he's getting help, right? It would be extremely lonely and extremely demoralizing if he believed that it really was all on him. And nobody was helping direct him, and nobody was helping him at any point. I can tell you, for the short time that I was trying to make decisions for the shul, there was...
Yeah, the balabotim.
What?
The balabotim were there to help.
They're there to help, okay.
They're
Oh, that's called helping.
But the balabotim aren't there to make the psak.
No, not to make the psak, and not, Yeah. So that would be a counter-argument.
By the way, can I add something here? Our doing tonight is before Shlema for Achayal. Rachamim ben Ali Zachana Association of Tzahabik Bulaza Kafat al Rimon al Manat Atil al Chavira.
When?
I just got this text just
today?
I don't know. I just got this text now.
I didn't know. What's the name?
Rachamim ben Ali Zachana.
It's not really close. It's, okay. All right. Don't know. Okay. So find out about that. I wanted to point out, though, there is one other point that I want to make. It's similar. Barbara, it's actually similar to this point, but coming from a different direction, which is I actually put on the sources. I don't want to do it on my phone because I'm recording, but is anybody looking at it right now? Then maybe somebody could bring up the video clip that I put in.
I gotta find a video clip?
There's a video clip over there. Very, very important video clip.
A link to a YouTube?
Yeah, it's under the heading "The Potential Danger of Relying on AI for Psak."
Okay, I'm clicking on it now.
You're clicking on the YouTube link.
Yes.
Can I have your phone? Oh, perfect. All right, we got it.
I know Kung Fu.
Okay, so this is, of course, Neo in the Matrix, and I'll set it up. Neo, they've just started the process of plugging Neo into, I guess, other versions of the Matrix, where basically they're teaching him, he's learning through the computer all kinds of skills and all kinds of knowledge. And he's just spent 10 hours, mostly on martial arts. And he wakes up, and he says,
I know Kung Fu.
Make it louder.
It's as loud as it gets. So he says, I know Kung Fu. And then Morpheus says, show me. And then what happens after that is the next scene in the movie is that they go into a computer program and they start fighting Kung Fu, and Morpheus beats them up for about 5 minutes, and then finally Neo gets the upper hand. I'm going to assume that you guys know what I'm talking about for just the sake of this. This is a movie called The Matrix, where Keanu Reeves plays a character called Neo, where they discover that human beings are really plugged into basically a video game, essentially. And they have been since they were babies, and they're living out their lives in a video game, and then he gets unplugged and he discovers this. But basically what's happening over here is that he can be replugged into a computer and he can be fed information directly into his brain. And after that happens, he says, "I know Kung Fu." What does that mean? I mean, we've all fantasized about this, right? That instead of having to learn things, we could just get it shoved into our brain, right? And I think there's two interesting things about this. Number one, the idea that, you know, it happens in the movie. And the second is that Morpheus says, "Show me." And when they actually start fighting, he does know Kung Fu, but he still can't beat Morpheus until he practices, which is interesting. In other words, there is a gap between having the knowledge in your brain versus actually acting it out, which is interesting. Now, but I don't want to focus on that. I actually want to focus on the first part, the idea that you could actually have the knowledge implanted into your brain. And the question is this a good idea? Is this a good development or is it not a good development? No. What do you think? Would it be a good thing if you could have knowledge pumped directly into your brain instead of having to study it over the course of years and years and years?
If I decide which knowledge is pumped into my brain, I don't want...
Sure!
I want some foreign entity to say, here's what I want to put
okay,
in your brain.
Okay, fine, that's fair. I'm not suggesting that. I'm saying, you know, you don't want to study calculus because it's boring. Instead, you just like to know calculus. So here, take a disk. Take Google plugged into the internet, right? And then, boom, you've got it. Can you give an example?
If someone's very negative, for example, and you pump knowledge into them that it's good to think positively,
right?
You know?
Right.
So they have that knowledge that thinking positively is better than thinking negatively, but that's not enough because it has to. It's like the Kung Fu example. It's not enough just to know Kung Fu. It has to practice it. It has to actually change the wiring of the brain.
That's a great point. I think it perfectly illustrates what I want to show you next, which is a drasha from the Beis Halevi. So the Beis Halevi was Rav Yosef Dov Ber Soloveitchik, which is probably a familiar sounding name, except I'm talking not about the Rav from Yeshiva University, but rather about his great grandfather, after whom he was named. So the Beis Halevi was the first Brisker Rav of Brisk. And he wrote a sefer called the Beis Halevi, and in there's a drasha about the difference between the first luchot and the second luchot, first set of luchot that Moshe smashed, and the second set of luchot that he smashed. There's actually a beautiful drasha to read on Yom Kippur that he didn't smash. Sorry, it's a beautiful drasha to read on Yom Kippur because Yom Kippur is the day that Moshe Rabbeinu came down with the second set of luchot, and it would be nice to talk about the difference between the first and the second. We won't read the whole thing inside, but I do want to point out he points out a bunch of differences based on midrashim, and essentially the upshot is that the first set of luchot, what was written on them, not only the Asarat HaDibrot, but actually all of Torah. And not only, I don't mean Tanakh, I mean all of Torah Shebichtav, all of Torah Shebaal Peh, even to the level of everything that would in the future be said about Torah was written on the Luchot. How? Doesn't matter. Magic. Doesn't matter. Miracle. Who cares? And what was the point of that? Now imagine if you had Luchot HaBrit, on which you could find all of Torah knowledge. Any question you could ever ask, any piece of hashkafa, musar, halakha, would be on the tablets. What would life be like if you had that? Could we compare it to anything?
It would be a great reference source.
It would be a great reference source, right?
I think it would take out a lot of learning.
I would definitely take out a lot of... I mean, I wouldn't need to memorize anything, right? In fact, we have a word for this. It's Google. Right? If you ever want to know anything, you can just Google it. You just Google it, and you don't have to know anything. You don't have to remember almost anything. You just have to know how to Google. You have to know how to read, I guess. But that's it. So Moshe smashed that. Now, it was possible because people never were if they had only not done the Chet Egel, so then they, number one, wouldn't have sinned. And in a way, they would never have forgotten anything because there would be no forgetting because everything was written down in front of them. So there was never going to be any forgetfulness. When Moshe smashed the Luchot, it brought sin back into the world. When they did Chet Egel, it brought sin back into the world. And when he smashed the Luchot, it brought Shechecha. It brought forgetfulness into the world. Now, the second set of Luchot were different. The second set of Luchot were just the Luchot. Just the Aseret HaDibrot. Which meant, where did all the Torah go? So he has this beautiful metaphor. He says, if we had Mikodem, the Kol HaTorah Haya Ramuz Baluchot, Hayu Yisrael VaHaTorah Shnei Inyanim. When everything was written on the Luchot HaBrit, so the Torah and Yisrael, that's us, were two separate entities. The Yisrael HaMakayimim LaTorah V'Sharmim Ota V'Yu'az V'Bechinat Kli Shemunach Bo Torah. B'nei Yisrael would be the Makayimim of the Torah. In other words, the Torah would be this distinct entity, and we would be the repositories of it, because we would be the ones who would protect it and keep the Torah, but we would be separate from it. Aval achar kach dinitan lehem haTorah shebal peh, Torah shebal peh. Its nature is that we discuss it, we come to conclusions, we argue, we build it ourselves. So then, hem bebechinat klaf shel Torah shebal peh, ukumamar katov katveim aluach libecha. The moment it was given over to us to build instead of to just protect, we became the Sefer Torah itself. The Torah Sheba'al Peh was like the Dio written on us. We were the Klaf. And the Torah Sheba'al Peh was written on us. Instead of it being written on the Luchot and us being able to have to reach out and touch it, it was actually on us. Katvei Maluach Libecha. It was written on our hearts. What does that mean? I think what it means is that Hashem, at least at this point, Hashem prefers that we become part and parcel of the Torah learning and its development, as opposed to viewing it as some kind of objective, outside truth that we are just trying to access. We're actually part of the process of the development and the revelation of Torah as human beings, as Jews. And so, viewed from that perspective, I think there's two important elements. Number one, that we are an indispensable part of process. There is no Torah without human intervention. And so, I don't think it could be exported to a computer, because we are meant to be part of that process. And the second element is that, as he continues, and he says that it has to be acquired through Yegi'ah and through the Yetzer Hara. Yegi'ah means effort, and the Yetzer Hara becomes a part of the development of Torah. Now, this is a hard concept to understand, but it's not really that hard, because the Yetzer Hara is one of the most important characters in our lives, in Jewish life. And exactly. Thank you, Uri. Go back to my example I said before. You know, isn't the computer going to be a much better posek than a human being, because it knows everything, right? Except there's one thing that the computer, I'll say this way. There's one thing the computer will never know, which is what it's like to have a Yetzer Hara. It will never know what it's like to be human, because it does not have the Yetzer Hara. So you'll tell me, well, we could fix that. We could give the computer a Yetzer Hara. So I would say, that is a terrible idea. That is a horrible idea, and breaks some of the rules of how you're supposed to work with computers. The rule number one is, don't give the computer a Yetzer Hara. That's a bad idea. That doesn't end well in any movie. And so that's not going to happen on our watch, hopefully. And so there's something that's always going to be missing from that knowledge base of the computer, I presume, which is what it's like to be human. It's something that you can't ever teach it. And apparently what it's like to be human is an important part of the process of psak. The last point that I want to make is that, and this is Barbara's point, which is that what a tragedy it would be if all we had to do was ask the psak machine, because what would happen then? What would happen if people came to the conclusion that, you know, okay, we've developed this computer, we've put all this knowledge into it, and we've taught it to teach itself, so it doesn't need us anymore. What will happen? We won't be doing this anymore. What need is there to learn any Torah?
Well, it's an argument that the Schottenstein and maybe even the Shulchan Aruch in its day is the forerunner for...
You're right. There's always been arguments like that. And they've not been wrong because they're wrong in principle. They've just been wrong because they've been wrong in reality. In other words, the advent of the Shulchan Aruch didn't bring an end to Limud Torah. In the years after the printing of the Shulchan Aruch, you can find, if you look on a graph, you can find that people stopped writing on Shas and they started writing on Shulchan Aruch. In other words, there was a proliferation of super commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, which reduced the amount of commentaries on the Gemara. It didn't reduce the amount of Torah. It just shifted focus in terms of what people were writing about. It's kind of leveled off. It changed back, it's moved away from that. But if you look in the 16th, 17th century, people started writing on the Shulchan Aruch. It wasn't like they stopped learning Torah. They just started learning a different part. And with Schottenstein, you're making a good point, but I think it doesn't reduce the amount of Torah that people are learning. It just means that people are learning more, almost. But the problem with the computer is that there's no point in learning. You've exported, right? You've exported learning of the Torah. And I think that could be a danger. Maybe you're right, it's not a danger. But I think it's something that we should be concerned with and we should think about if we were ever to come up with the idea of, let's just export Sack so that, why it's a hop, skip, and a jump from that to let's export Ov Talmud Torah. Why should I learn? Anytime I have a question. People act like this already. They say, there's no reason for me to learn. I'll just ask a rabbi. There's no reason for me to look it up myself. Now, even if you look it up yourself, it's still a good idea to talk to a rabbi. But it's what we want, is to be able to look things up by ourselves.
Correct me if I'm wrong, when the Shulchan Aruch came out, not all Rabbanim were thrilled with this.
Correct.
Fact that, hey, everything is right in front of you now. Go learn yourself and figure out for yourself whether it's kosher, whether it's allowed.
So that's what James was saying, none other than the Maharal. The Maharal was one of the opponents of the Shulchan Aruch. And the Maharal actually said, and this is an amazing thing that he said, he said he thinks that Hashem would prefer that you try to come to the conclusion yourself by looking in the poskim, obviously, and getting it wrong, than simply looking up the Shulchan Aruch and getting it right.
Even though the Shulchan Aruch...
I think he lost that fight. No, I don't think. He lost that fight.
Even though the Shulchan Aruch knows a lot more of the sources that are required than I do.
Well, there's another problem with just looking at the Shulchan Aruch, which is that people don't know how to apply what it says in the Shulchan Aruch to their question necessarily. Could be that they may misread the Shulchan Aruch, or it could be the Shulchan Aruch is talking about a certain situation or the circumstances that are different than yours. There could be many reasons why it should be discouraged. The Maharal's point was that he felt that it was going to lead people to be lazy and not to try to figure anything out for themselves, which would be, I think, a major concern if we ever turned towards machines. I think, without coming to, without ruling on anything, I think it would be useful, and I would not be surprised at all if one day somebody did come up with some kind of psak machine, and it would be useful in the sense that you would use it, and then you would use it as a tool for coming to a conclusion yourself. In other words, you'd say, okay, here's what the computer thinks. Let's analyze it ourselves. Let's figure out what we think. And I'm just reminded of how useful it would be. I'm just reminded of Rav Schachter used to tell a story that he used to learn with Rav Willig, to Rosh Yeshiva at YU, and they used to learn when they were younger. They would come up with a question. No, you said they would actually look up directly. They would look up a shayla in the Igros Moshe of Moshe Feinstein. They look up the question. And they wouldn't look at the answer, and they would learn the sugya. And they would try to come up with a conclusion themselves, and then they would look into Rav Moshe to see what he thought. And he said, they got most of the steps, but then it would inevitably happen that Rav Moshe would quote like a Gemara in Krisos or in Menachos or in Zvachim, and something that they didn't even think was the right place to look, and they would have to adjust what they thought because they didn't even think that that was a source that would be relevant to the case, and Rav Moshe showed how it was relevant. So I imagine some kind of model like that one day happening, where a computer comes up with You know, not necessarily even a psak, but you say, okay, here's a computer, this is what I want to know about. And even if it just printed out a list of sources, even if, we don't have that yet. Even if the computer by itself knew how to print out a list of sources, that would be interesting. That would be useful.
Make sure much easier.
And computers are already making sure much easier, right? Rabbi Shlomo Rosner, you know, he says, you know, we don't like to talk about this, but, you know, the advent of Bar Ilan, right? You know how long it used to take? I don't even know how long it would take a rabbi to come up with a shiur, because he'd have to go to the photocopier. And he would have to find the book in the library, then go to the photocopier, print it out, and then, you know, find the right line and cut it, literally cut and paste. Literally. And now, I can go online. If I know what I'm looking for, I can make a source sheet in 10 minutes. With, you know, two sides, probably even four pages. I can make it in 10 minutes, just copying and pasting from Bar Ilan, and, you know, it would take nothing. And even if I didn't know what I was looking for, I could look up a Gemara and then look up 20 commentaries just like that, without having to go to a library shelf. And that's manual, you know, that's me doing it. Imagine if a computer knew what it was doing and knew how to make kishurim, it would be very easy. It's not even that hard. They're already doing it. There's a website called Safaria that already knows how to make knows how to make connection. It's very simple connection. If this pasuk is quoted in another source, it can link you to the other source where it's quoted. Easy. You're giving a shiur on a pasuk. It'll easily give you all the sources that it has in this database where that pasuk is quoted.
That's not so complicated.
It's not complicated at all, but it's extremely useful. And it's a lot more useful than saying, okay, I'm going to go look it up in that chumash, and then I have to go look it up in that chumash, and then that chumash, and then that chumash, and then I have to think, okay, I wonder if it's quoted in Michtav Meliyahu, right? And good luck finding it, right? So it does it for you. You know, that's already useful. So imagine where it got smarter and knew how to figure out what's relevant, what's not relevant, which Google does, right? So that would be useful. But to use it as a bottom line psak, I could see a lot of pitfalls there. Okay.
Isn't there some concept, just something that I don't find relevant at all, some concept about we all have our own chelek in the Torah?
Yeah.
So is that...
Right, those are... You know, once you go down the mystical road, I think you're definitely gonna come to the conclusion that it's not a good idea. But yes, absolutely. V'tein chalkenu b'toratecha. It's chalkenu. I have a chelek. Right, that each person has a letter in the Torah that corresponds to his neshama. These are Kabbalistic ideas that you find in the Sifrei Chassidus, you find in Zohar, in which case it reinforces the idea that there is a direct connection between us to Torah to Hashem, and that cannot be replaced by a computer. So there's that.
Something else is on my mind here. We're talking about a computer giving a psak, because it's got perfect background to give a psak.
Right.
Even with that psak that I get from the computer, there's inevitably going to be somebody who disagrees with this psak. When do you get a psak? How common is it to get a psak where all rabbanim agree on it?
I think you're pointing out a general problem, which is a problem even without a computer. How do I come up with a conclusion? Right? You ask me a question, and I say, all right, I'm going to look it up. I see Rav Moshe Paskins this way, or Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's Paskins that way. What do I do now? And I'm actually asking you guys, what should I do? It's really hard to figure out, and it's not always the same answer.
No, this is where knowing the person and...
But even if I did know the person sometimes, my father's pointing out, right, even if I did know the person perfectly, and I wasn't, let's say I didn't even care who the person was, I want to know, theoretically, what's the right answer. Rav Moshe Paskins this way, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach that way. What do I do? So I have a few options. One option is, I can go out and I can see, well, how do most people act? It's a legitimate option. What does the world do? Does the world follow Rav Moshe? Does the world follow Shlomo Zalman Auerbach? That's actually probably the easiest and simplest thing that I could do. Another option is that I could evaluate myself. What do I think? Do I think Rav Moshe is right, or do I think Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is right? That takes courage, and it takes time, and it takes effort.
It takes an enormous ego.
Yeah, well, ego, it takes courage.
It takes
confidence.
Is Rav Moshe right? Do I have the right to think, hey, is Rav Moshe right?
Sometimes you can do that. Sometimes you can say, look, I've studied it. I understand where he's coming from. this one feels more correct. And it's not as if to say that he's incorrect. The Gemara says there's always 49 reasons to say Tameh, 49 reasons to say Tahar. I'm just saying it speaks to me more this way. Now, a computer could also do that based on its own criteria. It could say, look, I prefer this kind of proof versus that kind of proof. It could figure out how to do that. The computer could also, by the way, and this is what it probably would do, it could evaluate how have previous poskim determined these kinds of disputes. Right? What do people usually do? And it could probably do that better than I could. Right? If you asked me to figure out, okay, how does Rav Moshe decide between, you know, when the Shulchan Aruch passing is one way and a major Achron passing is another way? Now, I would have to read through all of Rav Moshe and I'd have to come up with some kind of theory. The computer might actually be able to do it better than me. So in some ways, these things could be done better by a computer, if we're just talking about from an analysis, logical perspective.
Just to lamchish, you know, that point with the extreme example in a capital case.
Right.
If you, God forbid, were the accused,
right,
and were up for the death penalty,
would you want to
prefer a computer?
Right. Which is happening, right?
Or a human being.
Which is happening. Computers have become, artificial intelligence is already involved in I think in America they found this, and it's made people very upset in the judicial system. I forget exactly that, Jake, do you remember? I just was reading about this recently.
I see a lot in sports.
No. It just came up recently about, I think, which cases come up or the parole board. Yes, I think that was it. It was the parole board, like the deciding who's going to be up for parole or something like that. Yeah, and it's really disturbing to people. Now, what's interesting is, why is it disturbing to people? You know, we'll talk about this next time when we talk, next time probably when we start talking about self-driving. But, and I actually have, I don't know if I should spoil it now. I have a great, there's a comedian that does a great bit. Should I spoil it now? All right, we'll spoil it now. Maybe we'll watch it next time and you'll forget by next time.
Triple the attendance of this year.
What?
Just focus a little bit more on the multimedia
component. Well,
and a little bit less on the other stuff.
Yeah. I have a great clip of this comedian. I'm going to turn it off so that everybody who's not here can't hear it, and then they'll have to hear it next time. There's this comedian. Actually, I don't even know his name. I don't know if he's great or not. I just heard this joke.
Tesla and Torres, the first.